Hey fellas, welcome to Guys in Grief. We started this podcast for fathers like us that have experienced pregnancy or infant loss. We're not doctors, we're not psychiatrists, we're three friends. We're grieving fathers that have been through the unthinkable and want to help others by discussing the unique perspective of men that have experienced child loss. So join us as we share stories, advice, laughter, and tears, all while seeking to honor our children, support our family, and find better days ahead. Let's get into it. To another episode of Guys in Grief. I'm Brad.
I'm Brian.
I'm Brandon.
Hey, what's going on, boys? How we doing, guys? Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Great seeing you guys.
Still kind of reeling from our last episode with David Kessler. That was to get such a world-renowned voice and such a just thoughtful leader in this grief space was incredible. And I think we're going to continue to hopefully partner with David and his world with his grief certificate program. Right, boys?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. He dropped some jewels.
Yeah. And I think this program and his education is going to help a lot of the dadvocates that, we set up for grieving dads out there. So I think it's going to be really incredible experience, for the dadvocates and some of us to go through that program.
Completely agree. So go to grief.com. You can check out more about David Kessler's grief certificate program and all the millions of resources he has available. And go to guysingrief.com and you can find out more about our Dadvocates program if you want to have a one-on-one conversation with a fellow like us. Brian, you recently had one, right?
Yeah, really quick. And then I'm excited to jump to our guest.
Was that air horn? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. wait. Talk to a dad.
Yeah, so I just thought really quick, we always like to tell little stories of how we're going through this grief journey early in the pod, but I just happened to have a coworker that lost his daughter, Eleanor, at 34 weeks, which I know, Brandon and Brad, you guys are familiar with that type of loss and what it can do to the couple. And I got to say, talking to him really kind of, I wasn't expecting it. It brought me back to that moment of those early days when we lost Austin, and to see the pain and I could feel it for him.
Yeah.
And as we all know, there's not much you can say. What you have to do is be there for them and know that, tell them that you support them and ask them to talk about their lost one. Because I think it's, a good thing, but I got to say, it really was gut-wrenching seeing, especially a coworker, somebody that I've known for a long time, go through something like that, because it's always something we never wish upon anybody. And it just really brought me back to that first day. So it's just a reminder that it never leaves us. The grief is always going to be there, but I think it's just important that we're always there for each other. And I don't know if he's ready yet, but eventually I think he's going to jump into this community that we're building, which I think is a good thing. But, we're giving him space now, Lindsay and I. But I just wanted to tell that story quick that, it really kind of brought it home, to that first day of losing a child.
Completely. Thoughts and prayers to him and his family.
Yeah.
How lucky he is to have someone like you in his corner, man.
I don't know about that, but...
Well, I mean, hell, we've all shared our first episode of this damn thing was going back to work and how difficult that was.
Yeah.
And not having somebody to talk to. So the fact that you're talking about literally a work colleague being comfortable to have that resource, you make a huge impact on this whole grief community, and you probably made an even massive one with one-on-one conversation there, Brian.
Yeah. Thanks.
So speaking of somebody who's made a massive impact on this grief world and community.
Good segue.
Ooh, that was good, right?
Yeah.
Pro style.
You did it before.
With going from David Kessler last week, there's few people that we could follow up with that would be on that level. And we have her. And we are so blessed to be able to welcome, let me do this bio here, the incredible Chris Carr. Chris Carr is a multiple New York Times bestselling author wellness activist, and cancer thriver. Love that. Mm. She's been called a force of nature by O Magazine and was named a new role model by the New York Times. Chris is also a member of Oprah's Super Soul 100, not a big deal, a group of the most influential thought leaders today. Other media appearances include Good Morning America, The Today Show, and The Oprah Winfrey Show. She and her work have been featured in Glamour, Prevention, Scientific American, Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and other national publications. Chris has helped millions of people take charge of their health and live like they mean it through the award-winning blogs, books, online courses, and membership communities. And as we talked before starting the pod, has impacted our own family members and our personal lives. So ladies and gentlemen, we are so honored to welcome the one and only Chris Carr.
Guys,
triple
bingo. There it is.
All three of us.
Some 1990s technology.
Yeah.
Oh,
I love it.
Yeah, Chris,
hold on, wait.
We all use Riverside. They gotta upload. So they gotta do some improvements there.
Come on,
Chris. We are on. Thank you so much for being here. What an honor to have you.
It's an honor to be here. As I was saying to you guys beforehand, I don't get to have these conversations with guys like you very often. So when you reached out and I learned about you and became total fans of yours, I just feel very blessed to be here.
I get chills hearing that type. It means so much, honestly, because, you know, we've been doing this thing a little over a year now, and you know, people like yourself and David Kessler, who we just referenced, and Rebecca Sofer, who we've had, have just inspired us to put our toe into this world. Mm-hmm. And you all are just blazing right through it. So we're honored to be a part of this with you. We have a lot to talk about.
Let's go.
We want to try to get into all of it. For the few people that might not know you, can you just give a little bit of your backstory personally and how you have become such an influencer in this grief world?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's so interesting because I entered the wellness world first and foremost, and not because I had any desire to like be in the wellness world. I entered it because, like many people, it's a warning sign or a wake up call. And when you have one of those, you're like, what am I going to do? And for me, it was being diagnosed with an incurable stage 4 cancer. So I've been living with cancer for 21 years. It is stable, but it is stage 4
cancer.
Yes.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Good for you.
Honestly, that's like, as I was writing my book, I don't think I really connected the dots between my diagnosis and grief. Because I immediately got busy. I got busy trying to figure it out, putting together the team, making a healing plan, learning how to take care of myself, changing my diet and lifestyle, then teaching all the other people how to change their diets and lifestyle, writing all the books, all the things, really good stuff, all driven by fear. Underneath it, sitting on a reservoir of grief. And
wow,
people outside of me have been like, but wait, you've been in the grief community for 20 years. And I was the last person to understand that I was. It wasn't until I lost my dad, who's my chosen father, that I really understood how much grief I was suppressing.
Wow.
When you lost your dad, did it feel like it was just, it unlocked like grief that was kind of within you a lot?
100%. So my therapist said something really powerful. She said, when the grief train pulls into the station, it brings all the cars.
Yeah.
It's true.
Clip marked.
The stuff that you thought you were over, the stuff you actually didn't even realize was such a big deal. Right. And it all came home to roost. And I have a philosophy. It's because we live in this, as you guys know so well, this very grief phobic, messy, emotions averse society. Right. We're not taught how to deal with these emotions or storms of the magnitude that so many of us, yourselves included, have faced. What we're taught to do is suppress. What we're taught to do is run. What we're taught to do is avoid. Right. And that we're taught that because it's a part of survival mechanisms. I don't even know how much, I mean, I know for myself specifically in my family, there were certain things you didn't address, right? So there's a chapter in my book about anger. And my grandmother, who partially raised me, used to say, that's very unbecoming for a lady. You know, crying was very unbecoming. So there's certain things that I was taught to avoid. Mm-hmm. But from an evolutionary perspective, this is hardwired into our DNA, right? Because we will avoid whatever it is that mm-hmm. threatens our survival. And grief feels like it's a threat to our survival.
Right? Wow. Massive point.
Yeah, I mean, that hits home a lot to me, too, because a lot of our listeners know I also had vocal cord cancer. I was diagnosed when I was 29. And at that age, I was in that survival mode. So I did kind of avoid and like almost pretend like I didn't even have it. I was trying to go on with my day as if I wasn't going to radiation treatments, you know, daily. It was just, I mean, like, no, I'm still going
to
work.
We went to Atlantic City, and on our way home, we stopped for you to go to get radiation. Like, you were still just living life. That actually happened. Do you remember that?
Wow. I do. Yeah, You and Jess came with me.
That's right.
Yeah, so what was the moment after you were diagnosed that, or was there, like, a pivotal moment that triggered either you to jump into the wellness space or write the book? You know, was it the loss of your father, or was it something earlier than that to really dive into, I'm not a morning person?
It was, so this is my seventh book, and I have to say that it is also very good to have a focus, to have a purpose, to continue living, right? Because we need that too. But I think that I was out of balance with that for quite some time. And so I just wanted to call out, like, if you, what would you, Atlantic City, you went to Atlantic City during radiation, like that might've been a really great thing, you know, because again, we're still ourselves. We're still the person that everybody knows and loves. And sometimes when really difficult things happen, it can make us feel like, oh my God, cancer is becoming me. I am still me. Grief is becoming me. I am still me. Like, I still need to stand and fight for me. And I think that's a very healthy thing. For me, it became a place that I could hide. So that's when you start to know, like, is this good for me? Or is this a distraction? Or is this, like, actually destructive for me? And so I just want to just clarify that for anybody out there, because it's, as you guys know, it's really hard to just like sit with your feelings all the time.
Sure.
Yeah. We've talked to a lot of dads that they just go back to work. You know, if they lose a child, they don't want to address it. They need to be doing something to sort of keep their mind off of it.
Yeah. And that's a good thing. I think when it becomes counterproductive is when we're burying our feelings, because I think feelings are energy and they're information. If we think about them as information, that we know that there's a lot of growth and expansion that they have to teach us. And if we think about them as energy, we know that energy has to move, otherwise it becomes stagnant. And when I think that when energy becomes stagnant, it has a way of either coming out the back door, which is often quite messy, or we start to kind of implode. And so that's why I think it is important for us to make sure that we're not like stuck in these places. But for me, to answer your question about the writing of the book, so if we go back a few years, I was approaching my 20-year anniversary of living with cancer. My dad was dying of cancer. My business was struggling because of, you know, specific choices that I made to pull back. And I realized, wow, I really haven't life-proofed my business. If I'm not doing, we're not earning, you know what I mean? And we're in the middle of a global pandemic. So it was like a grief super disco.
Super
disco. You know?
Yeah.
And my publishers wanted me to write a different kind of book, like an uplifting, let's lift everybody up, you've got this kind of book. And I was like, I don't got this.
Not even close to hotness.
Yeah, relate to that.
Yeah. So that's when I started this project first and foremost for myself. And I hope that other people would resonate with it. But like anything, that when you dive into a project, especially something as big as writing a book, for me, this took 2 years, an enormous amount of research, an enormous amount of my own therapy and deep work. And so it really helped me tremendously, because I have to say I came to the topic of grief truly as a newbie. Even though I had experienced so much of it, I was a newbie.
And is that why you entitled it, "I'm Not a Morning Person"?
100%, because I didn't want to be.
Yeah.
Makes sense. In your book, you talked about, you kind of touched on a little bit of Brian's question, but you talked about the difference between getting over and getting through. Can you further elaborate or explain the difference and what we can do to get through?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I know you guys know this so well and talk about it, and have brought this conversation forward in such incredible ways. I think when we're new to this conversation, the first thing we hear, or maybe we even feel, is like, when am I going to get over this? When is it going to be over? Or maybe well-meaning people in our lives. I have a chapter that's about awkward times, awkward people, and the effed up things that we hear. And sometimes the effed up things that we say, because we don't know what to say, so we shove our feet into our mouths, right?
Yeah, right? We talk about that a lot.
Yep.
The crazy things people say. Yeah.
We could go around. We could create a drinking game of all of them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we've got them.
But so what I realized, and what I think we can agree on, is that grief and love go hand in hand. And the more we love, the more we're going to grieve. And when I love deeply. There isn't an over. It's not like we can tie these things up in a neat little bow. There's no timeline. There's no shame if we're still really hurting years and years and decades later, right? Our hearts are big and beautiful, and they feel deeply. And that's a privilege. And I think we live in the society where, you know, what we see on Instagram and what we see in social media is so polished. So if therefore any of us show anything other than that polished, perfect life, we're flawed in some ways. And I think that the goal of us being human and having that opportunity to be here in this time and space is to be whole. And we come to this planet whole, and our goal is to leave as whole as possible, which means we can't amputate any of our emotions and expect to be intact people. Oof. And yet that's what we try to do, especially with grief.
Yeah. And especially with men too. You know, I think men repress it. Or were you going to say the same thing?
Brett? You read my mind, bro. Keep going.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of what you're saying is men like to really repress and avoid those emotions and feelings that are going, you know, to come out eventually, like you talk about often in everything you do. So, yeah, I think a lot of men can relate to that.
I don't think men have role models for expressing grief. Emotion. And how are we supposed to do something if it hasn't been modeled for us?
Ooh.
You know, you're left to figure it out by yourselves. Ooh. And I think that there's more role models for women to express their emotions than there are for men. And I think that men get a really bad rap. I also think that there is this pressure for men, and maybe it's pressure that is also self-induced, which is about fixing things.
Totally.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And so
we talked about that for sure, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's actually a big problem in a lot of relationships. Like when I'm in my right mind and I'm not just like having knee-jerk reactions with my husband, I will come to the table and say, "Hey, I need to talk, but I don't need you to fix it." So I'll like set the stage, and that relaxes him. Like he gets out of that mode where he's anxious because he's like, "Oh my God, my woman's hurting. I gotta fix it." And then as soon as he enters that posture, I'm like, I want you to listen. I don't want your advice.
Yeah. Yes, all three advice tips you gave me suck. None of them. Yeah. I don't want any of them, dude.
Knew that already.
Yeah, exactly. You didn't think I already thought of that? Yeah. What a brilliant point. I know. Yeah. Jessica's standing right here staring at me. What a brilliant point that men don't have sort of emotional role models in that way. Like we don't really have people that we've seen do it well. And have you ever seen the brief like TED talk about the first follower? This came to my mind. If not, I'll send it to you guys. It's an older one, but it's one of my favorite. It's a clip of like a crazy guy at a crazy smart guy at like a music festival, and he's just dancing like nobody's watching on a cliffside. And at first, everybody's just watching the crazy guy, thinking he's odd. And then one person, the first follower, goes up and starts dancing with him. And now one crazy guy inspired somebody else to just come up and have some fun and be a part of it. And that started a movement. And then by the end of like the 90-second clip, there's hundreds of people all doing this weird, awkward dance that the guy was doing. And it's just this like creating a movement, being that first follower. And I kind of feel a little bit like we're those crazy guys on the cliff trying to do the dance and just get some first followers here of like, guys, just be vulnerable. Just jump in. Just have the conversation, because the opposite is worse, right? The suppression of it, the weight of it, the neglect of it is absolutely worse than addressing it.
You're so right.
That's great.
I shared with you guys before we started recording that I've done a lot of media and I've done a lot of interviews specifically for this book. I've probably done about 150 interviews. I have not had any interviews with men. Okay. I have had interviews with men and gentlemen who want to talk about wellness, who want to talk about me, who we can work the book in, but nothing like what you're doing, which is why it was so exciting to me. And so you're definitely the first, you're the leaders. And
the crazy guys on the hill.
Yeah, you are. And I want to
dance very well, though.
Just keep dancing.
Neither could this guy. Yeah.
Chris, I've got a sort of another question, because I know what it was like for my wife when I was going through cancer. And it sort of goes back to the discussion of fixing things. Like, I know when I was diagnosed, she wanted to fix me, and there was really nothing she could do. I'm curious to know, like, how you and your support system, your husband, maybe other people in your life, sort of how they went through your diagnosis, and when you lost your father, how did they help you through the process that was meaningful for you?
That's a great question. I will start by saying that, when it came to my diagnosis in the early days, my family and my now husband, he was not my husband at the time, were just very supportive. They're on board for what I wanted to explore, for, you know, the things I wanted to talk about, the journey that I took, which was a very integrative journey because there wasn't any treatment at the time. And so I wanted to do something because I wanted to participate in my well-being. So they started to eat the weird food that I was eating and do the things that I was doing, or at least, you know, entertain the conversation. They also help with the logistics, you know, and we know when somebody is sick or you're going through a loss or, you know, creating a funeral, there's just so much. It takes a lot to come into this planet. It takes just as much to leave. Mm-hmm. We are not prepared for death. We have the baby showers. We welcome in the new life. But when the life passes and ends, so few of us, first and foremost, know how to talk about it. Secondly, know what to do. So it's done in silence, or it's institutionalized, or it's...
There's no handbook.
There's no handbook, yeah. Right? But actually, there's a lot of information out there.
Totally. Yeah.
And yet... each and every one of us will face this time where we come up short, unless we do this work now. And nobody wants to do it, because I think a lot of the times we think, Oh, that's such a downer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to talk about end of life stuff. I don't want to prepare. I don't want to think about a good death. I don't want to understand like what's going to happen to me as my body is dying. I don't want to figure out where my jewelry is going to go. Okay. You know, like I don't want to have those conversations, but I actually think that there's a real peace of mind that comes with that level of ownership and responsibility and like taking care of my business from start to finish.
It's a brilliant, go ahead, Brandon.
No, I have a random question. I'm just going to go out to everyone, but like, these are kind of similar conversations I'm having with our families. And I don't know if it's a generational thing, but actually, it's not, because I'm speaking about this with other families. My family doesn't speak about this type of stuff as much. My dad's like, don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. Everything is going to be fine. And me, I'm like, well, no, I would like to know, like, everything's scheduled, da-da-da-da-da, bullet points, we're here, we're there, everything's okay, I want to make sure. And he is just so nonchalant about it. My mom is, like, very, like, everything's fine, we're okay.
Just let him be.
Just let him be, right, and I'm like, we got to talk about this stuff because I want to be ready, like, God forbid it happens, I want to be scheduled for this. So I don't know if this is a generational thing or not. I don't know if you guys are seeing some of those things like that.
Yeah.
Brandon, you know my father.
Yeah. That is
planned to a T.
GK is all
which is almost a little scary, but that's a different
point, Chris, I saw on your social media, you talked about your connection with your dad in sort of the later years. I think you called it the golden years that, you know, he wanted to have with you kind of sooner, where we all kind of assume that once we retire and we've made enough money, then we're going to have these golden years. But in reality, we should have it sooner because, you know, why are we wasting all this time?
Yeah, I'll definitely touch on that. I think that, Brandon, you're so right about how certain people approach it and others are not ready. And so what I like to do, or I'm trying to do, is take other people's lead. You know, like at the time, my dad wanted to talk about it. And I was afraid to talk about it because I was afraid I'd fall apart and then make him feel bad or make him feel responsible. And so I had to do a lot of work with my therapist around figuring out how to talk about death with someone who's dying. Mm. And so what we did was we started by saying, well, let's first have like a pre-show warm-up. We're going to start by talking about it. We're not going to just dive into the conversation, but we're going to say, hey, would it be meaningful to you to talk about these things? Mm. And so I said, I'm going to probably cry. I'm going to feel very uncomfortable. I'm going to feel like I'm getting it wrong. And he said, I would like to talk about these things because it's very lonely.
Mm.
And
wow.
So then we started to open the door to it. So if on the other end, you know, you're the child of a parent who doesn't want to talk about it, it's like, hey, I'd like to start by talking about it at some point. It doesn't mean that I don't think you're going to have a long, wonderful life.
Mm-hmm.
But just like bringing somebody into this planet takes a lot of work, helping to usher somebody out also takes a lot of work. And I want to show up right for it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start that process slowly, but know that it would be meaningful to me to be able to have the conversation.
Well, and what a great parallel for lost parents and their support system. Because the talking about it thing, at least for guys, I would love if one of my guy friends at some point in time said, hey, whenever you're ready to talk about Beckham or Ari or your loss, I'm here for it, right? Like, let's talk about it. And that doesn't really happen all too often, right? You know, your families, what a great piece of advice for a lost parent, but for the support system of that person to just, it's almost breaking down that barrier of communication to make sure that there's a comfort and a time and a place for it, as opposed to just putting it on the table and expecting the conversation to go well necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it adds sort of a level of trust that, you know, that person cares, and it's not like this awkward moment if you see them in the future. I think it's great advice to support system out there. If you're struggling to figure out what to say to, you know, a lost dad, that's talking about it is a good strategy. I like that.
It was helpful. And I feel like I didn't answer one of your earlier questions, which was about fixing it. My family showed up for me in a big way, and so did my friends. But I have to say that when my dad was newly diagnosed, I went into fixing mode. Hmm. And I remember when the nutritionist at the hospital, I was in the room, and she was, you know, giving my dad some nutrition advice going through chemo and radiation. And she looked over and she saw me and she was like, "Wait, are you Chris Carr?" And I was like, "Mm." She's like, "Oh, just don't worry. Do whatever she says to do, because you're in really great hands. You know?
You're the Chris Carr. Yeah,
okay. Okay, you're fine." But my dad didn't want to hear that. He didn't want to hear it from me. And I was in fight or flight. I was in, I cannot lose my person mode, mm-hmm. you know? So what I did for myself and all the things that I learned in 20 years, I was basically like, "Oh, I'm going to fix the fuck out of this."
Mm-hmm. Nope.
You know, like, not on my watch is my dad leaving. Like, I'm Chris motherfucker. All right, we're getting this done.
That's right.
And he wanted none of it.
Ah. Oh.
He couldn't deal with all the things that I was throwing his way. He was just holding on for dear life, trying to get through chemo and radiation, right? And do what he could to feel good. And we were lucky to have 4.5 years with him with very aggressive stage 4 pancreatic cancer. So I had to realize that I didn't have to fix it. I had to show up. And this is, I think, so much of the conversation that you guys do so beautifully is learning how to be present for somebody, how to show up, how to listen, how to give your full self to somebody in a way of like, "I see you. I might not always know what to do or how to do it, but I got you. I'm not going anywhere. I can sit in this pain with you. We can be vulnerable. I can show you love in a way that I know I got in me, but I maybe never expressed it before." That was the medicine that I had to bring to the table, as opposed to, "Here's the supplements, here's the thing, and here's now you're moving your body, and are you getting enough sleep?" And like all the regimented shit that I wanted to do to make cancer go away, I couldn't do. I had to lean into this kind of medicine.
You don't have to fix it, you just got to show up.
Right. Excellent point, Brad. The word that keeps resonating in my head while we're talking about this is compassion. I don't know why. It just keeps like hitting me in the head, like compassion, compassion, compassion. Honestly, I have no other thoughts on that, but that word just keeps resonating with me when we're talking and hearing
you speak. That's a great point.
That's it. I'm sorry. That was it. That was all my.
That is the word, though. You're absolutely right. And Brian, I know you want to say something. I will just add to the compassion thing. It was really, that was the turning point for me. And it was uncomfortable at first. So maybe you guys can resonate with this, because if you are a fixer, you're just like, "I'm out of sorts. I need a job, you know, but this is what I do. I need a job." But then I was like, this isn't your job. So what else are you going to do to survive? How are you going to get through this mentally, emotionally? And I said, okay, I don't know what this looks like. And it might sound foofy, but I am going to lead with love. Love will show me the way. Only love in the room. Love will tell me what to do in difficult times. Love will tell me how to apologize when I fuck up, and I will. If I put love at the center of this experience and the intention is that love leads this, I can't screw this up.
Is that chapter 10? Chapter 10?
Yeah, I think we can end the podcast.
This episode of Guys in Grief is brought to you by BetterHelp. Mental health after child loss is incredibly difficult to navigate on your own. And at Guys in Grief, we advocate for men to be vulnerable and seek help through therapy. Therapy has provided each of us with tools to approach our lives in a very different way.
And that's why we're excited to tell you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp's mission is to make therapy more affordable and more accessible. And this is an important mission because finding a therapist can be really hard, especially when you're limited to the options in your area. BetterHelp is a platform that makes finding a therapist easier because it's online and can match you with a professional therapist in as little as a few days. And if you click on the link in our show notes or go to betterhelp.com/guysandgrief, you'll get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp. If you don't really fit with your therapist, which has happened to us and is a common thing in therapy, you can easily switch to a new therapist at no additional cost without stressing about insurance, who's in your network, or anything like that. So invest in your mental health today and consider online therapy with BetterHelp. Go to betterhelp.com/guysandgrief to get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp.
I mean, some of them were in a tough spot. Some were a little bit better, but at least I knew the community was a little bit bigger and I was less alone, which I know we've all felt immediately after, you know, something bad. But I'm curious to know who your role models were after everything you went through.
Well, I'm very lucky because the work that I do brings me to a lot of interesting people, and I get to learn from a lot of people, and I've met so many people on different stages, and, you know, certainly I'm a Hay House author, so we're like a family, and you start to learn stuff that you never knew before. You know, like I didn't know as many mediums as I know now. You know, so it's sure. Like my world exploded.
Did you know a lot then? Did you just know more now, or was it zero to some?
Any. So what I do, it brings me to a lot of interesting people. But I have to say that, you know, my dad was probably my biggest role model in a lot of ways, because my biological father left when I was conceived, and then we met when I was 18, and then I wrote my first book, and I said something in that book that he didn't like, and he left again, and then he passed passed in my early 30s, and so there was so much grief and loss on the sort of paternal side.
Yeah.
That was a big, remember when I said the grief train pulls into the station and brings all the cars?
All cars.
It was the early diagnosis, but it was also this deep sense of abandonment that I think that a lot of the choices that I made in my life were as a result of that, good and bad. And so, but my dad coming into my life as somebody who was, and I believe still is in the way that he exists now, an example of unconditional love and an example of, I could go to him with absolutely anything, any problem. I could go to him and feel as though I wouldn't be rejected. I would be loved. It's not to say that it could be a problem that he totally disagreed with. It could be a behavior that he thought needed to be adjusted. It could be him calling me out. Like I remember my first job at the Danbury Fair Mall. And before then, when I was a teenager, I did a little shoplifting, guys. I did a little shoplifting.
What? Chris
Carr? At the Danbury Fair Mall, there's a hot barrette.
Is there a warrant out for your arrest?
And it is hot because it's been stolen.
It's literally been stolen. No pun intended.
It was a hot barrette, and I was an early teen. And, you know, my mom hit the roof. You know, she's like, you know, she's going to. What all the things, total hysteria. And my dad brought me back to the mall, and he brought me to the manager, and he was like, she has something to tell you. And I'm like, I took this marriage. And I gave it back, and he was like, good job. I know that was hard. The manager was just like shocked and like, okay, thank you, not knowing what to do with me. And he was like, all right, let's get a hot chocolate and put this behind us. Because he knew I would never do this shit again.
Yeah, he knew.
I would never do it again.
But my point is that.
But 30 something Chris finds that hot barrette again. She's got.
The 52 year old something Chris.
Whoa! Yeah. Never would have guessed that.
It was a very large bow, so I'm going to say no to that.
It all comes back.
It really does come around. What is old is new. You just save. Here's the other tip, guys. Save your stuff, because it all comes around.
I was out playing street hockey with the kids earlier, and everyone's wearing like the huge glasses, like Bret the Hitman Hart. And I'm like, I had dozens of those things. Yes. Right? Yes, they're everywhere.
I had those too. Excuse me.
Yes. They're all over the place.
They're all over the place.
Yeah. So, Chris, we're going to. We've talked a lot about the grief world and your book, and we wouldn't necessarily go on a chapter or whatnot, but we actually want to go a little deeper on you with you on the wellness focus, because it's such a unique space. And I love the work that you do in linking the benefits of wellness to grief and just tying this all together. So can you talk a little bit about the links between, quite literally, wellness and grief, how you've found yourself really, you know, you started to talk about it a little bit at the beginning, like they were down that path first and then kind of the grief chain pulled in. What can guys learn, or anybody, but you know, maybe there's a guy spin to it too, on focusing on their wellness to help in their navigating their grief journey?
Absolutely. So let's talk about how grief shows up in the body. It shows up as fatigue. It shows up as insomnia. It shows up as weight gain, weight loss. It shows up as brain fog. It shows up as so many different actual physical, tangible symptoms, because it is a physical experience as well as an emotional experience. It's both. And so I know you guys know this, but and anybody out there listening, you know, when you're going through a difficult time and your family's going through a difficult time, like, for example, you're going through a diagnosis and a loss or whatever it is, there are so many decisions that have to be made. There's so much going on that you got to be sharp about, not to mention the fact that you are aching down to your fucking marrow.
Yeah.
And so how do we keep our wells filling off, not overflowing? Not, I'm not saying like we're at peak performance, you know, like, no, we are not
emotionally
at peak performance.
Shredded.
Yeah, that's right. We're crushing. You know, this is not the time to crush.
Emotionally shredded. I've never said that one before.
It's just not. But I think there's this pressure to always be at peak performance and always be that guy who's crushing and always be that, you know, to look a certain way. And if we go back to that idea that you got a lot of pressure on you and you got a lot of shit that's coming up, you do not want to be depleted, because you're going to make shitty decisions. You're not going to show up for your family right. You're not going to show up for yourself right. And you're probably going to make things worse. I know when I am depleted, my go-tos are not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
They're about numbing so that I can avoid. But if I can keep my well just full enough, I always say a thimble size amount of self-care starts to fill that well. You take, you know, you lower the bar so much that you're going to trip on it and give yourself a fucking concussion. Like, that's how low you got to lower the bar so you actually do it. You know what I mean?
Damn right.
And so you are showing up. You're like, hey, I'm not 100%, but I'm showing up and I can take care of myself. I can take care of my people. I can make these decisions. I can move forward, even though my heart is aching to the marrow.
That's such a good point. I mean, I can't tell you how many times when after we lost Austin, my wife and I would have these arguments and we would look back and like, hours would go by and then we'd apologize to each other and realize it was just straight up fatigue from just the grieving and the crying. And it would come out like in a bad way. Like you said, it was like angry. And I'm sure a lot of guys can relate to that. And you're just like, I don't know why I'm freaking out right now. I'm mad. Like, and then
I just can't get off it.
Yeah, so and then you get some sleep and you're like, whoa, I don't know who that guy was, but I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's such an amazing point. So much, and I'm going to call myself out on this, Chris, a little known fact that many of our listeners don't even know, but Brian, I originally proposed naming this podcast Whiskey Recommended. And because, then our sponsors were like, cool title, probably nobody's going to know what you're about. They're just going to think you're like recommending whiskey, which would be cool.
Bunch of alcoholics.
Yeah, right. But they were like, I appreciate the sentiment of like, this world is hard. And, you know, but also we don't want to be yeah, we're having a drink now. Okay, like, you know, do you, but like, not that we didn't want to imply that that is a healthy way of navigating grief. And so it was, this title is much better, Guys in Grief. But I think my point with all of that is, like, there's a natural inclination for men to try to solve and then try to not.
Yeah.
Like those two, that feels like there's like two binary things here. It's like, try to solve it, then try to numb it, then try to solve it, then try to numb it, not try to heal it and talk through it. And
yeah,
I think that wellness focus is, because you're right. I mean, I think all of us, you know, experience the things that you're talking about.
I think is important for guys too. Yeah, it's such a good call out. You don't have to be like the perfect dad or husband, you know, when you go through a loss like this. Like, just be there, you know, like get rest, you know, support each other, talk to each other, love each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's little things you can do that will add up and, you know, get you through the journey.
I want to say one other thing, because I think this might be helpful to your listeners, and it's been very helpful to me. It's something I still try to practice. My friend Cheryl Richardson has a book called The Art of Extreme Self-Care. And as an extreme person, which is me, I was like, oh, I like that. Extreme! But what is this about? But there's a chapter called Let Me Disappoint You.
Oh.
And I try to reread that chapter every year, because I have such a hard time disappointing people and saying no to things and backing out of things if I said yes to it. But then, oh, God, this is actually too much for me. What was I thinking? I was a yes Pez dispenser because I was probably anxious and I didn't want to let somebody down. But when you're going through these difficult times, it's like, I want to push us, myself included, to keep getting comfortable with disappointing people and just sitting with it and not having to fix it. Just being able to say no as a complete sentence and let that silence ring. You don't have to come back with like, but I love you and you're amazing. And really, it's me, not you.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks, T Swift. I need to read that chapter. I know many people in my life that need to read that chapter. It's a phenomenal point.
It's just too much for me right now. So no, that's all you say.
I'm a fan of the same.
Brandon, you're a role model in that space.
Yeah, Brad and I. Yeah, we were yes Pez dispensers. Yeah,
yeah, yes Pez dispenser. That's a good one.
In you.
Where do you find a delta in this world for yourself, Chris, between women and men? Because I will say, I was on your website earlier today, and I love everything about it. There's a part right on the front that says, I've spent more than 20 years helping women reclaim their health and vitality. And so do you find that same rules apply to men? Or is there you know, maybe some deviations here of where men's wellness becomes... Is there different tools or pathways?
I think the fundamental basics are universal, right? Mm-hmm. But I think first and foremost, each and every one of us are unique. And more women gravitate to my message. Hopefully that's changing, because my message is really universal. But yeah. I think for whatever reason, and maybe when I first started, it was some of the language that I was using, not just that I was speaking to women, even though I wasn't saying women, it was just like the tone that I was using and the kind of examples that I was using. I think that they maybe narrowed the audience that I had.
Sure.
But I think going back to the idea that the principles are universal, we all need to take care of ourselves. I teach what I call the 5 pillars of wellness. They apply to all of us. It's the basis of lifestyle medicine. So it's about being mindful about what you're eating, what you're drinking, what you're thinking, and how you're resting and renewing. And the pillars rest on a foundation of stress management, because stress creates inflammation, and inflammation is the leading cause of many of our illnesses. So this in combination, in synergy, again, is the basis of lifestyle medicine. It's true for a man. It's true for a woman. As we age, things change. As women age and they head into perimenopause and menopause, our wellness needs change. as our hormones are changing. But again, I think it's universal. I just, for whatever reason, have resonated more at this time with women. But I am hoping that changes, because why wouldn't I want to talk to guys like you and have a good, have a blast? Like,
yeah, we'll come be influencers on it.
Please.
I think it's going to change. I think wellness is so important for grief. When we lost Austin, I just started running. I was like Forrest Gump, just like, I'm just going to run. But like, I'd get home and I did feel like rejuvenated. Like I had, weirdly enough, more energy than before I left, because my heart was going. The alternative was just sitting on the couch and just sitting in my thoughts and grief. And I think wellness is so important for men going through grief to just, and again, it could be 100 different things. It could be one of your pillars, like change your diet, do something. But I think it makes a difference. It truly does.
Well, Brian, Brian, opposite you, instead of running, I ran to the refrigerator because I was so I was running to the kitchen and like making everything under the sun and cracking open a couple beers. Like, not to a point where I was going nuts, but I was like, good. Like,
you bought a Peloton. You got on the Peloton.
Yeah. I did buy a Peloton, and me and you did have a couple races here and there, which I think you cheated. But anyways, we're not going to talk about that. But no, for real, like, it's funny. Like, I went total opposite on that because I just wasn't in the mood.
Yeah,
I was like, man, fuck this, like,
and that's amazing that everybody has a different journey,
and different path for it's awesome.
So, Chris,
you want to explain it?
Any advice for listeners that know wellness is right for them? Right, like everybody in the world knows I should eat healthy, I should work out. Like, these are just fundamental truths that most people realize that they should do, but when you're in the depths of your grief, is it that lowering that bar so low? What's a first step for somebody that's just saying, like, all right, I hear Chris Carr, she's amazing, I read the book, but it's easier for me to sit on the couch and grab a drink and to wallow in my sorrows than to focus on my wellness? What would you say to that person?
Sometimes that's exactly what needs to happen. There isn't a right way. If anybody gives you a 5-step process to overcoming grief, run. Because it just doesn't work that way, right? We can certainly benefit from everything that we learn, but it's such a personal and unique experience. Like, Brandon, I love that you went into the kitchen, because the kitchen is such a healing place. It's your home.
That is my safe place. I think you said that, but I really enjoy cooking. Like, I do like cooking.
I enjoy your cooking too.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. But I really enjoy cooking and like making sure the family eats good and make sure the family enjoys what I'm cooking. So I guess that's like my warm spot of just like, if I'm chef, I'm gonna make a phenomenal meal tonight. I'm pissed off. I think I'm gonna make a great meal tonight.
Amazing.
Right. Real quick, let me piss you off some more. Hold on.
I like this mood. But right, so, that's where your creativity is, and that's where you can go to heal your heart. So I say, yes, we're talking about wellness and that it's important to keep our tanks full enough so that we're able to navigate this difficult time. But if we take a bigger step back, and you think about, well, like, what's my unique path? We know that we can't navigate these things by ourselves, because we start to isolate. And when we isolate, we cut off. It's very hard to heal when we're in that cut off, shutdown place. And so first and foremost, who's your tribe? Who's your community? Who are your people that you can connect with? Like, you guys so beautifully model by being willing to connect with not only each other, but with everybody else. So, like, who is your group that you can go to share your heart? And is it time for you to talk to a therapist or a counselor? Like, so many of us avoid that. I don't need that. Or it's going to make
especially men.
Yeah. It's going to make me feel like insecure. Like, what are people going to think about me? Fuck what people think about you. You need to talk about this stuff. And if there's one thing that helped me was when my dad was diagnosed, I'd been in and out of therapy for many, many years, decades. But when he was diagnosed and I knew the magnitude of what this diagnosis was going to be and what it was going to do to our family, I was like, you're dragging your ass back to the couch, you know, because this is going to be way too much for me to navigate by myself. And so I would say, first and foremost, find your support, right? Be really hardcore about it. Don't be like, I'm going to find my support next week, the week after that, 3 months from now. No, tomorrow after this episode, call your people, network, get on the fucking Google, find your support because you need it. And from there, the next thing I would say is fully alive living. You are here to live. I know you lost somebody. I know you lost your former sense of self. I know you lost your job. I know you lost something, but you're here to live. That is what your commitment is to keep moving forward. And so what does fully alive living look like for you? It's going to change with every decade. But if you can start to put that into focus, it's something that becomes the compass that pulls you forward.
Beautiful. Well, Chris, I'm so bummed we're at 50 minutes already. I want to do another 2 hours and 50 minutes. Chris, you have been incredible. You have been such an inspiration up until this moment and certainly for the hour we spent together. And I genuinely hope we can stay in touch with you and partner in some ways. And knowing that you haven't spoken to many men in this space, you know, we're here to be a light and we want to continue to make those lower that bar for others so that they can continue to help move forward. So just Brandon, Brian, any final words before we start to wrap with Chris?
You're a true inspiration. I mean, thank you so much. I truly think your message is universal to men and to grieving fathers who have lost children. And thank you for everything that you're doing for the community.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for seeing a light on these two fellas' faces here. Like how much you have helped them alone, that means a lot to me and speaks volumes to the work that you're doing. So on behalf of myself, I appreciate you and we thank you so much.
Thank you guys. I adore you, Triple B. Oh.
I like that.
Well, taken already, but we got it.
Yeah. So we will link to all of Chris's amazing, I don't know if we can link to all of them because there's so many amazing outlets, but her website, her socials, go check out her many amazing books. Her most recent one, I'm Not a Morning Person. We are astounded by you and so grateful to have had you. Thank you so much, the incomparable Chris Carr.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
And listeners, thank you so much for another amazing episode. We'll talk to you on the next one. Love you guys.
Love you guys.
If you valued from this content, we ask you to share this podcast with others who could equally benefit. To leave us a 5-star review on whichever platform you're listening to help us improve our outreach. Check out our website and follow Guys in Grief on Instagram and Facebook. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.